Hello, and welcome to Press TV News Analysis. I'm Kavit Tafoyi. Another U.S.-led soldier has been killed or injured. Just one of the headlines that is not highlighted in Western media, which practically occurs every other day, but part of the reality in this 10-year-old U.S.-led war. And to add more to the woes of the U.S. and U.S.-led NATO countries, green-on-blue attacks, the killing of NATO soldiers by Afghan forces, a spike this month totaling over 40 deaths. This is while even as this war costs the United States close to $300 million every day, over a third of Afghans are living in abject poverty, with many suffering basic living necessities like electricity, as an example. Well, in this news analysis, we'll look at U.S. strategy in that country, and we'll present facts that point to the contrary of the U.S. 2014 withdrawal announcement.
The toll keeps rising. So far this year, Afghanistan soldiers and police officers have killed more than 42 foreign troops, many of them Americans. The latest incident took place in the eastern Lagman province, where an Afghan army soldier turned his weapons on foreign troops and killed two of them. It's the ninth such attack on the U.S.-led forces in the past weeks. Increasingly concerned about the rise in such deadly incidents, the U.S. and its allies have already taken steps to stop the trend. They have ordered all their service members to always carry a loaded magazine in their weapons. Another initiative is a program dubbed Guardian Angel. The plan calls for one or two soldiers to monitor the Afghans during every mission or meeting. The so-called angels, whose identities are not disclosed to the Afghans, must be prepared to fire on anyone who tries to kill a coalition service member. But there's little optimism that such measures can make a substantial difference. The commander of the U.S.-led forces in Afghanistan, General John Allen, said last week that only about 25% of all green-on-blue attacks have been the result of Taliban activity, like infiltration. The declaration confirms that the other three-quarters of such incidents have been carried out by members of the Afghan security forces, who have no links with the militant group. What makes this story more complicated is that many Afghan commanders do not find the figures at all surprising. They say they understand why their men are shooting U.S.-led soldiers. The reality is that Afghans are deeply hurt by the way foreign soldiers treat Afghan soldiers, civilians, their religion and their culture. The desecration of the Muslim holy book, the Quran, disrespecting Afghan corpses and deadly night raids are only instances of the hatred felt for Americans and other foreign forces. Afghans say many of the foreign forces are racist, arrogant, and simply do not respect them. That's why these days U.S.-led troops are busy watching their backs, just in case some disgruntled Afghan recruit decides to avenge some insult. Some analysts say beyond the negative effects on morale, green and blue attacks may impact the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan by 2014. Washington is facing another predicament in such a politically delicate time at home, just a few months before the U.S. presidential election. The administration of President Barack Obama has to deal with diminishing support for an already unpopular war, with mounting complaints from outraged parents of dead soldiers. And maybe it's now time to say enough is enough.
Let me introduce our guests from Dignity, Human Rights, and Peace. Randy Short joins us from Washington. We have international lawyer Franklin Lam, who joins us from Beirut. And we have Middle East consultant Peter Iyer, who joins us from London via Skype. Gentlemen, welcome. Peter Iyer, first to you. The increasing green-on-blue attacks, acts of revenge, as they are really in essence, in which over 40 U.S.-led troops have been killed just this month. I mean, you have the threats of militants on one side, and then now you have the Afghan colleagues of the U.S.-led soldiers. It was so bad that General John Allen had to go to President Karzai and ask for help. How can the U.S. resolve this issue now?
Well, I think what we're seeing here is a rerun of what actually happened in Iraq, because when the troops first moved in, they were welcoming them into the various cities around Iraq. And then in a very short period of time, the residents of those cities in Iraq realized that they weren't actually fulfilling the dreams or the wishes of the local people. And again, you can see this very distinct resentment of occupational forces telling the Afghans what to do. It was quite incredible, for instance, in Iraq, that the Americans helped write the Constitution of Iraq, which, you know, you and I know should be written by the people themselves. And we've got this over-influence of the Afghanistan political scene and the militarization of the country, which is pure occupation. And it's not there for democracy. It's there to fulfill their geopolitical plan for the country. The TAPI pipeline was a major part of that. And also, what a lot of the world doesn't know is to protect the opium crop, not to delete it, but to protect it.
Franklin Lamb, I guess there are talks about the geopolitical purpose that Afghanistan as a whole serves for the United States. Can you expand on that for us?
Well, frankly, I think I can't think of a legitimate purpose that it solves. The day that we began 10 years ago, it was a tragedy. It's been a tragedy for 10 years, and the tragedy will continue even if we do pull out next year. What we tried to do failed. As an empire, we tried to keep influence there. We tried to dominate. Same thing the Soviet Union tried and failed to do. I think history is going to note the ugly, iconic images, which are the death of the wedding parties by so-called collateral damage and the innocent civilians who were killed, and also the burning of the Quran. There is no way we can stay there. And there was an interesting conference this weekend at the University of Oregon, and the subject of the whole conference was about why Afghanistan. Nobody wants to be there except, some militarists in the American society. It's tragic. We've got to compensate those people after we leave. We've got to submit reparations. But I see no geopolitical advantage that we can now obtain. And I think we must just leave as quickly as possible.
You mentioned a good point there, Franklin Lamb, and that's about the U.S. militarists, as you mentioned there, to use your words. Randy Short, let's expand on that a little bit more, because if we want to look at who's leading this war, it seems pretty obvious that it's the United States, because basically it's the U.S. who's asking other nations to contribute to this war up to $1 billion a year. Now, records vary whether other countries are doing it. That's 50 countries. Meanwhile, the U.S., they're contributing up to $3 billion a year. So you have the 50 countries, $1 billion, U.S., $3 billion. Why is the U.S. so insistent on, quote, carrying this war?
Well, I think that depending on who says being in Afghanistan is not in the strategic interest of the United States, it is for those persons that are in the major corporations and, again, the banks that launder the drug money. But if you look at the Obama doctrine, they want to encircle China and the Soviet Union. Afghanistan has a small border area with China. It is another way for them to curtail the growth of the world's soon-to-be largest economy. I mean, this is what hasn't been mentioned. In addition to that, it is a way to keep Iran under pressure. Iran is a major threat to the strategic interest of the American empire, and as much as they are now the leading nation in the non-aligned movement. So perhaps sometimes Afghanistan isn't that important on one level, but on strategic level, it gives a presence. It's a way to put pressure on India, pressure on Pakistan. It's a way to choke point the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf, depending on who you ask. So America has a lot to lose. Inasmuch as the economic power of the country is decreased, now the only real force that America has is its organized violence through the military. So you keep the war going to show that, hey, look, the dollar may not work, we may not make anything anymore, but we sure can beat the hell out of you if we don't like you.
But that's no way of winning hearts and mind, Peter Iyer, is it, if your land is being used that way? When we look at Afghans vis-a-vis the amount of money that the United States is spending for this war, $300 million a day. Why is it that after 10 years of this U.S.-led war, a third of Afghans are still living in complete poverty?
Yes, that's a very interesting point that you've raised there, because it is absolute poverty, and there's certainly no development. There's no jobs for the Afghans, so that situation is never going to go away. And I find it incredible that, as our guest said in Washington, I would like to correct a point here. This is not necessarily a total U.S.-led situation. It's a new world order-led situation, and those countries that have been taken out are part of the seven Islamic countries that the new world order were targeting. Iraq, Afghanistan, the Balkans went, Libya's gone, Syria and Iran, etc., etc. So it is a geopolitical plan. And the amount of money that they're spending on this war effort still is quite minuscule compared to the amount of money that they're making from the arms industry and, of course, the price of oil going through the roof. And it's all part of a greater return for the New World Order.
And part of this New World Order, Franklin Lamb, Randy Short mentioned, is getting closer to China. Now, we know that the U.S. is repositioning its strategy for Asia. The majority of U.S. military warships are supposed to be moving to the area, if some haven't already. Do you agree with that? I mean, we're seeing also that how U.S. has pretty much opened Myanmar to the situation. We know that there's a border of Myanmar with China. So is this getting closer to China as part of the long-term goal?
Well, our colleague mentioned the New World Order, which, as we recall, was announced in 1991 after the so-called President Bush victory in expelling Iraq from Kuwait. And he was 90% in the polls for a while. Of course, he lost the election. It may be. But that there is a plan to squeeze China. But at this point, it seems to me that the American, our government, as opposed to our people, made a huge mistake in Iraq, Afghanistan, we're making it in Lebanon, in Syria, etc., to, of course, the benefit of the ascendant power, which is Iran, with whom we really, if we want to look after our interests, we should, you know, have good relations with. But there may be this effort to squeeze China, but honestly, we're not in a position to do it. Economically, there's no will among the people to do it. Militarily, we can do it for a bit longer. But it seems to me that this election in America, after the election, hopefully we're going to see some change, because the people have certainly realized, as Ron Paul, the man who should be elected president, said just yesterday in a large rally, you know, we've just made a tragic, tragic mistake. And we've got to salvage it. We've got to come home, leave these theaters that we've disturbed, and look after ourselves. And that project is so urgent, as you know, and it's being compounded almost monthly. We've got to come home, look after our infrastructure, our cities, and our people, and leave these areas.
Okay. Well, Randy Short, I think this would be appropriate, this question, to you, since you represent Dignity, Human Rights, and Peace. On two fronts, the United States is losing. One, it's the civilian side in terms of deaths in Afghanistan. So morally speaking, we've seen what that is doing to that country. Then within the states, when it comes to the veterans whom are coming back, and we hear about these rather large numbers of suicides that are taking place almost on a daily basis, if not every other day, based on recent stats. Is there a point that this is going to perhaps be a turning point when it comes to the veterans, especially of ones that are fighting currently, that this is not a war that they want to be involved in? Do you see that coming up on the horizon?
I think it's a little more complicated because, of course, you would think that the veterans would already be opposed to it, but there's certain things that happen with the veterans now. How many of them are deeply, deeply addled by the psychotropic drugs that they've been put on? We have people who are deeply indebted. We also have a society where a large number of veterans are being killed. We had one shot to death just last week in Baltimore. We're having veterans who are coming back. A disproportionate number of veterans that come back to the United States are homeless. In particular, if they're the same color as I, there are hundreds of thousands of them. They are killed. They are marginal. No one really cares about them. And right now, this country has been militarized to the point where you hear this mantra of support the troops if they're killing people abroad, but piss on them when they come home. There has not been the support for the veterans to even be able to stand up. The public is still largely blinded by 9/11. 9/11 becomes the ring, or I'm trying to think of the term that you use when you hypnotize. It's the hypnotic disc that you keep saying 9/11, and therefore people can't think or criticize. So there hasn't really been a question as to why all these wars. And persons who question that right now, where you have this hyper-patriotism in the country, makes it very difficult. And if you look at it, you look at the Occupy movement, how brutal the police forces were against veterans. This didn't happen after Vietnam. So this country is very different, and I don't know what it will take for it to be a tipping point. And I think that in terms of what the last gentleman said, what I think will happen in this country will be mass austerity. I believe it's coming. And only when thousands of people suffer worse than what they're doing now will people begin to ask, why so much for war? And
okay, Peter Iyer, let me come to you. Let me come West to you, Peter Iyer.
And Mississippi, where almost one quarter of the people are not food secure. There will be a tipping point when people really can no longer run from reality.
Another tipping point, Peter Iyer, is what this so-called war against terrorism has really produced the opposite. When we want to look at its neighbor and what is going on there, not to mention within Afghanistan and this anti-U.S. sentiment, and it's raging in Pakistan. And of course, most recently has been time and again these U.S. assassination drone attacks. So what is going on there? Isn't there intelligence that is leading the U.S. to see that their policies are producing this? And of course, we can mention about what has occurred inside Afghanistan, for example, with the Quran burnings and the killing of Afghan civilians. In other words, are there more terrorists that are being produced in their so-called fight against terrorism?
Well, I'll just briefly go back to our guest in Washington, because he gave reference there to 9/11. Of course, 9/11 was an inside job and nothing at all to do with Iraq or Afghanistan. The next issue is the problems with the vets. I'm in touch with the vets and quite a few other groups over there, and I can assure you that most of the mental problems with the troops are a direct result of the WMD. Their own depleted uranium weapons are causing the mental disabilities. So we'll push that to one side and now move on to the North Pakistan scenario, because, yes, as you rightfully said, the drones are breaching Pakistan's sovereignty on a daily basis. The Hellfire missiles that are fired primarily by the drones are quite inaccurate. British pilots used to fire these a long time ago, and they were known for going straight through the window of a house out the other side and striking an adjacent building. And now, of course, the IDF are using them in Egypt. You know, when is this breach of sovereignty going to stop? And then we come back to the war on terrorism. There is no terrorism. There is no Al-Qaeda. This is a false facade created by the New World Order. There is no threat to anyone's street in London or in Washington or New York or anywhere else. They're all inside jobs. And the sooner the public understand that, the better.
Well, the general public, Franklin Lamb, was presented this past May with a strategic pact that was signed between the United States and Afghanistan. What do you think of this pact? I mean, was it a way to show that the Afghan government is approving the U.S. presence in their country, when at the same time you have these night raids, for example, which is in violation of the pact, happen time and again, not to mention other things that are in violation? I mean, what kind of pact is this anyways?
Well, I just want to say that I think Mr. Short's analysis about what's going on in the States and what's happening with his concept of a tipping point is exactly right. I haven't been there for a while, but I remember the old days after Vietnam, and I think we're going to have some cataclysmic events, and it's going to be up to every American to take charge and improve our society. I think the agreement between the Americans and the Afghan government as opposed to the people, very evident. And the purpose was to keep a foothold in Afghanistan, to soften the specter of withdrawing in 2014. But we're not going to withdraw, are we? We're going to have training missions there. So I think that so-called strategic agreement was to keep the lines open to the economy and to keep the channels open for flying arms, and also to keep plenty of agents and personnel in Afghanistan to monitor, as a gentleman said, the border with Pakistan and China, and just have a presence there, and as a deterrent or an observation post with respect to Iran. We've given amazing gifts to Iran, as you know, and one of them is Afghanistan, besides Iraq and Lebanon now. I think that was just a document that made with a corrupt government, corrupt president, just to keep a foothold and open a channel if we have to go back.
And Randy Short, I don't know if you're aware, but this 16th NAM summit is being held here in the capital, Iran. And one of the issues discussed that has been declared in their communique on the meeting that they had is occupation. And of course, Afghanistan's got to come into the picture. Do you think, since the UN has not reacted, we hear about these depleted uraniums even being used in Afghanistan, amongst other atrocities that have taken place, that it is up to an organization like NAM that contains all these countries to perhaps do more in order to solve the situation of this occupation that is going on?
Forgive me, I'm having a hard time hearing you. You're asking me a question about the importance of the non-aligned movement and the conference that's going on presently in Tehran. Am I correct?
Yes, vis-a-vis the UN and their lack of action in terms of what's happened in Afghanistan.
Oh, yes. Wonderful. Let's be real. The United Nations is going the way of the buffalo and the League of Nations and the dodo bird. It has shown itself to work against national sovereignty, the rights of man, and a range of things, and it's become essentially the prostitute of the New World Order, and in fact, a mercenary prostitute that attacks those resource-rich countries that are seeking to emerge as their powers in their own right. So some of the fundamentals of self-determination and human rights that would be part of the UN are no longer on the table if the powerful nations in the Security Council that have imperialist agendas wish to destroy them. So this emergence of NAM is wonderful. It needs for more nations to step up to have a counterweight in a world that needs to be multipolar, no longer unipolar, just drawn by the former colonial powers of Western Europe. I think that this is the hope for some peace and hope for some deterrent, inasmuch as since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States and its allies have gone, they're crazier than Frankenstein on crystal meth and crack in terms of how they're treating the nations of Latin America, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. So something must stop. And this looks like a promising, rational, humanitarian way for nations to come together to get themselves off the hit list, because no one knows who's next anymore.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much. You were just listening to Randy Short from Dignity, Human Rights, and Peace from Washington. And Franklin Nam, international lawyer, gave his statements from Beirut. And Peter Iyer, who's a Middle East consultant, spoke by Skype from London. And thank you for watching another edition of the Press TV News Analysis. Do send us any comments or questions that you may have the old-fashioned way, newsroom@presstv.ir. That's our email address. From Mikhail Vitafoy and the entire team, it's goodbye.